rock and roll. We got another Build Your Legacy session with my mentor, Annie Dickerson. Super pumped up to have her. Apparently today is her live day, so she goes on back-to-back podcast all day long. But she's been my mentor. I think she's involved in like $1 billion worth of assets under management as a co-GP, has been my mentor for numerous years on the capital raising space. We did a series called Raising Money Minute where we broke down nuances, all kinds of really cool stuff, and even did some mindset training. So that was a lot of fun. And even dove into the world of quantum mechanics at some point. So that was really cool. But let me have you introduce yourself a little bit, Annie. What can you tell us about your background? How did you get into this capital raising thing?
Sweet. All right. Hey, everyone. Well, thanks, Ruben. It's an honor to be here. And just as maybe I've been your mentor in certain aspects, you've been my mentor in certain aspects too, on the quantum space, the mindset space. And I feel like I'm still catching up on a lot of that stuff. But for everyone who may not know me yet, I'm Annie Dickerson, founder and now chief brand officer of Good Egg Investments together with Julie Lamb. She's our co-founder and CEO. And she and I really got started almost 5 years ago now. And as of yesterday, guys, we just hit our $25 million mark distributed to investors. And so we've now officially distributed $25 million in returns. As Ruben mentioned, we've been part of over $1 billion in real estate assets. We've done about 40 syndications to date in the last 4.5 years. And we've raised well over $100 million. Started out scraping the bottom of the barrel, not being able to raise even $1 million, not even $500,000. Our first deal, we raised just $420K, which included $100K from me and my mom. That's how bad it was. And now we've gotten to a point where we've got 10 people on our team, as I was mentioning to Ruben and Andy here earlier, and we're all rowing in the same direction. And we've got this machine that we've built that's attracting the right investors and helping them get into the right opportunities. So I'm thrilled to be here today. I know a lot of you are on various parts of the journey. So I'm excited to have the opportunity to share whatever little tidbits I can to help you wherever you are.
Very cool. Andy, let me turn it over to you, brother. Tell us a little bit how you got into real estate and where you were at on your journey.
Yeah, sure. So I came out of college just a whim, right? Everybody else is becoming paper millionaires. I'm aging myself a little bit in the 2000s, early 2000s. No one wanted me. So I decided that we take a job at a boutique real estate company. And then we kind of, advanced a little bit into brokers and then development. And then we started kind of buying some apartment buildings, across to California, mostly Central and Southern California. Then it just kind of made sense for us to expand a little bit to the built-to-rent space in the Southeast. We still love multifamily, obviously, but we really feel like the built-to-rent trend is really where we want to spend a lot of our time. I'm just excited to talk to Annie because I remember, early on in the game trying to be all things. And I think what she preaches a lot is about, finding a partner, finding that avatar, figuring out the process, right? So I just kind of bumped my head against the wall for many years, things that I wish I would have figured out. And obviously you advance if you stay with it long enough, right? You can be a dummy like me and stay with it long enough. I'm really excited about sharing her wisdom with the group.
Yeah, that's gonna be a lot of fun. So real quick, so I'm the host of the Capital Raiser Show. Anybody that doesn't know, would like to say hello and welcome everybody. There's some insanely crazy, amazing people in the room today. So I see so many faces. Welcome, Kara. Just saw you pop in here, family office guy. All right. Well, let's go ahead and get started here because, I've been developing and raising capital for a little bit, but I still have a lot to learn. And, some of the things that we could potentially talk about today, including, include capital raising nuances or avatar creation. This is not necessarily the order of things, or for sure we're going to cover these things because I have some different questions actually that are not in this list, but maybe how to keep investors warm, or hopefully we won't spend more than a few minutes on syndicator websites, but that's a little important piece. I know that you can go insane for like an entire 45 minutes just on websites. So we'll try and keep that short. Effective investor communications. Maybe Andy could talk about white glove experience. And, maybe we can even go down into story brand, story selling, or emotional versus logical selling. So, but before we go down any of these roads, Annie, I know that you just got off a webinar where you're talking about how to make your first 100K raising capital. Is there any brief mentions of what you were teaching in that particular, you know, class that you did?
Know your numbers. That's the number one thing to getting to 100K. You can't grow what you don't measure. And so we run into this all the time with people, even many years into the syndication space, who you ask them, how many people are on your list? How many people have joined your investor club? How many of those people have actually invested? And they can't tell you. And they don't know how many people are joining every week, how many calls they're getting on. And they're just, I think it's good. I think we're moving in the right direction. But if I can impress one thing upon all of you, is to really dig into your data, to know where your leads are coming from, to know that conversion rate for every part of the funnel so that you can optimize. If you can just tweak every part of your funnel and improve the conversion by 1%, that's a huge change to your bottom line.
Have any comments on that, Andy?
Yeah, you know, we're using the EOS system, and that's been really good for us just in the way that we're kind of measuring everything. Obviously, KPIs evolve and goals evolve, but if you can kind of hold people accountable every week with the team, and I know your team's probably about the same size as ours, Andy, and, you know, it's a benchmark. It's easy when, you know, things are happening and you're busy and, you know, you're on the phones and it feels good, but there's many weeks where I felt good and I look back and I'm like, man, I really expected to hit these top three things, you know, that I just, that I didn't, I got bogged down. So just think it holds you accountable. So that's EOS is the book Traction. And then there was a follow-up book called What the Heck is an EOS? So we'll put that in the chat if anybody wants to check it out, but I highly, highly, highly recommend it.
Andy, I did a podcast recently with Bronson Hill, who I've just recently met. I think I met him in May at the Vertical Street Ventures Conference. He's been phenomenal, but he told me that he raised like $27 million and he did it all by himself. Like, he had to go and then track down the accreditation status. He had to get the money across the finish line. He had to do the automations. He had to do the podcast. And, you know, like this capital raising thing, I think it becomes a little bit easier when we have multiple people that are helping contribute to just that little tiny niche of the multifamily part, which is the capital raising piece in terms of team members. Where are you at there? And what can you tell us in regards to bringing more teams and scaling that capital raising business and portion of your co-GP?
Yeah. So our team right now is about 10 people. It started for the first 2 or 3 years, it was just me and Julie. We then brought on an admin. That was our first part-time hire. And she then grew with us into our director of investor relations. And then we started our coaching program, the Real Estate Accelerator. And then we started building up support there as well. And now on our team, now we've got a director of investor relations, but also we've started, because we're able to bring more capital to the table, we don't like to just bring capital to the table. We like to have a meaningful part in every aspect of the deal from inception all the way through exit. And what that means for us is we need to have that expertise in-house. So we now have a director of acquisitions and a director of asset management as well. And they bring the expertise in their respective roles so that we can participate with our partners from the very beginning when we're looking at deals together. It's not them looking at a deal and then handing it off to us. It's we're looking at deals together. We're underwriting, they're underwriting. We're comparing numbers and assumptions and models. And we're moving through to the acquisitions phase together, doing due diligence together. And so that's what scaling has allowed us to do, is get aces in their places, people in the right seat in the bus, so that Julie and I can focus on what we do best. And we can bring in that expertise in-house to give our investors and our investor community that experience and the control and lower the risk, all of which they deserve as part of their investment.
Annie, are the people on your team employees, partners? How do you have that structured?
Yeah, good question. So currently, everybody on our team is an employee. We have dabbled with equity in the past, and I don't think we've really figured out the magic bullet there yet. So we're still open to it, but currently everybody on our team are employees, some part-time, most are full-time. And we do have currently one VA on the team. But we do have an incentive plan. So it's sort of like a bonus plan. If we hit certain thresholds, then it's a profit share. So that what that means is that for the employees, they don't take on any of the risk, but they do get a piece of upside. And that helps everybody to row in the same direction.
Andy, can you compare that to the structure and organizational chart that we have at Legacy?
Yeah, I think, you know, we are doing more of the kind of equity sharing. So we do it per deal. It's hard when you do have equity. And if you're bringing on people that, you know, that's the only thing that they're doing, obviously it becomes very, you know, a stretch. So you got to have enough deal flow, I think. And I think you got to have the right people. I mean, the team is really everything. That's kind of actually my question, because I know that you and Julie, when you were kind of figuring this thing out and you've been doing it, what is it, about 4 years now? How long have you guys been together now?
About 4.5 years. Yep.
Yeah, about 4.5 years. So at one point you kind of discovered, hey, like I just hate being on all these investor calls, right? I want to do the content, or I want to do the writing, or whatever that is. And you know, I believe that you said Julie wanted to do something else. So maybe, like, what do you do? What did you do then? And what are you doing now? I'd be curious to kind of like the timeline.
Oh, that's a super good question, because it's been a journey. It's been, you know, most people think you go from point A to point B, but it looked more like this, where we're like, whoop, and we're going backwards and we're going forwards again. And now we're finally at this point. But yeah, it started out just as you were talking about. The reason we came together was because we were both trying to help the same target audience, which were busy working moms. And we realized she loves being on the phone and fielding investor questions. And I loved all the behind the scenes stuff, building the automations and creating the content, being on videos, all of that stuff. And so together we were this powerhouse, because then we could create that full investor experience end to end. And now as we grew, though, we kind of had to stretch outside of that. So while I was still creating content, I was taking on HR and legal, and we had stuff that was in the owner's box, and she was taking on acquisitions, and she was learning asset management, and we stretched. And, you know, to your point around the org chart, I highly recommend this for anybody. Even if you're a team of one, create an org chart for your future state. And right now, if you're a team of one, you might have, you know, 10 different roles on your ideal org chart, but put your name in every box. That way, you know all the different roles you're playing and all the different roles you're eventually going to be looking for. And so that's what we did. We started out and we were like, oh my gosh, I'm doing all these things and she's doing all these things. Okay, what's our first key hire? Where's our biggest pain point that if we hired somebody to do that one thing, that would free us up to do more of what we love? And so that's how it progressed one by one. And now we're at a point where she's doing what she loves as the CEO. And over the last year, I was doing what I hated, which was being the COO with the operations. I am not a great operations person, but there was nobody else to do it. And so for about a year, I was in that COO seat. I did the best that I could. I felt like I was Fred Flintstoning the car, you know, and I barely just got it over the finish line. But we hired a director of operations in April of this year, who has now grown into our COO. And he's fantastic. Operations is his jam. And so now I've been able to step out of that role and become the chief brand officer, which is more of my zone of genius. And so at this point in time, we are in I think we're finally back in our right seats on the bus.
So I see a ton of people here that have raised like anywhere from $1 to $20 million. Maybe we can kind of gear the conversation to some of these sophisticated capital raisers that are looking to scale. So maybe you could tell us, you know, what do you see people that have raised maybe an average of $10 million? If they're wanting to scale, what do they typically miss out on, or what would potentially benefit them as they scale into larger and larger capital raises?
Yeah. So I'm thinking back to that time when we were at that threshold. There's a lot, right? So up until, I guess it was end, maybe 2020, we were still sort of at that 5 million per deal sort of mark. We were hovering between sort of 4 and 5 million that we would raise per deal. And then in 2021, that's when we really jumped to the 10, 15, 20 million mark. And thinking back to that time, it's the operations and it's the people. And so on the operations side, with $5 million, we were still operating, even with automations, still in a lot of spreadsheets. And we had this homegrown investor portal that worked for if you're raising 1 to 5 million, but suddenly was kind of a burden when we were raising 10 million and above. So we then, one of the things we did was graduated, so to speak, to an official investor portal. It hasn't been all easy peasy and no challenges. Every investor portal has its pros and cons, but we've been able to get into a groove with it, and our investors know it, and it's a great place for us to connect with them, for them to get the self-serve resources that they need. And so that has taken out a lot of the back and forth communications. And then having the right people in place, the director of investor relations, a transaction coordinator, to really answer the questions, help guide people along, and track them throughout the process. I think those were key.
Ruben, one of the things that I remember, like, early, and I was raising money kind of, you know, it was really before the job sex. You were just like calling up people, dialing for dollars, right? It wasn't automated processes that you could do now. But one of the things that I always had a hard time with was managing the operator, right? Because at some point, that's your investors and it's your ass on the line, and they're not calling the operator, they're calling you. So I'm curious, like, maybe the early operators, and maybe now, just candidly speak about how many of those people would you invest with again? And what were some of those maybe hangups or things that you see a lot more clearer now that you didn't see then?
Ooh, brilliant getting question. Real deep. I like it. That's a good question. So with the operators that we started partnering with way back when we started, I don't think there's a single one that we still partner with now. And it's not that they're bad partners or bad people. It's just, you know, when two different companies are growing, they're going to grow at different paces. And a lot of times the philosophy might be a little bit different. And whereas it might be a 1-inch gap at the beginning, it might eventually become a 1-mile gap. And so that's what we started to see, was just a difference in methodology and philosophy for where we wanted to take our business versus where some of our early partners wanted to take their businesses. And so that's why we sort of transitioned. And now we have this whole process from the very first conversation to all the way through agreeing to move forward with a partnership, so that we get a lot of those. I mean, it's almost like dating, right? You got to ask a lot of those questions up front to really get to know the team, the people, so that you have this rock solid foundation moving forward.
Is your 10, 15 million a deal, is that all kind of retail, your avatar mostly, or does that include some other private equity people that kind of invest in your fund? Or
So the fund that we had earlier this year, not as part of the fund, but outside of that fund to fill up the deals, we did have some other pref equity partners fill in. But for the most part, if we're launching a deal that where we're looking for around 10 million, most of those are retail investors.
Wow, that's great. Thanks, Ruben.
Yeah, no problem. So I want to kind of go into two things, right? So I'm going to scratch a lot of the topics that I'd mentioned because they're a little bit novice for the audience that we have here today. But one of the things that I've discovered about you over the years is that you're probably, along with John Kasman, two of the most brilliant people in the understanding of branding for syndicators. Anything you can tell us about the importance of a brand or rebranding or maintaining something that attracts a lot of limited partners for the people that are hungry to either scale with co-GPs and or lots of limited partners? What can you tell us about branding? Oof.
Oh, man. Okay, I'm going to try to keep this brief, but your brand is arguably the single most valuable thing in your business. is not your investor list, because if you lost your investor list tomorrow, with a strong brand, you could build it back up like that. And so your brand, so I want to give you a quick example, right? Think about Coca-Cola. What is Coca-Cola? Coca-Cola is sugary water that's not good for you, right? But the brand that they've built up, right? People wear Coca-Cola t-shirts. There's billboards talking about how Coca-Cola helps to change the world. And you get this sense of like pride when you think about Coca-Cola. And even though when you think about it, it's this sugary, fizzy water. And that's the power of a brand. If you can take something that even by itself, because here's the thing, right? All of us here, we're doing more or less the same thing. We're putting out it on paper, right? We're putting out a deal, we're getting investors, we're talking to investors, answering questions, right? So at the baseline, we're all kind of doing the same thing. What sets us apart is the brand. And so that brand is your differentiator. That's why people will go to you versus somebody else. And if you can create that power of your brand, then it doesn't matter what deal that you put out or where that market is or what the business plan is. They're going to follow you no matter where you go. And that's the power of a strong brand.
A little bit further along that, you were talking about your brand can also, I thought this is very clever. One time I interviewed you and you mentioned this, is that your brand is what people say about you when you're not in the same room. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I forget who originally said that, but it's this concept of like a brand. It's this feeling and this experience. It's not marketing. So branding and marketing are not the same thing. A lot of people think that marketing is branding. Marketing is a part of branding, but it's not the whole thing. And so your brand, like right now, we could sit here and we could talk about Southwest Airlines. We could talk about Apple. We could talk about all these brands, right? And each of us has this preconceived notion or this experience around these brands, what they stand for, the impact that they have, our personal experiences with them. And that's really what you're trying to create at the end of the day is, when you're not in the room, how are people talking about this experience that you've created? What are some of those things that they're, those emotions that they're experiencing, and what are they telling their friends? Because if you can shape that conversation, that's how you're going to get referrals. That's how you're going to grow your community. And that's how you're going to raise tens of millions over time.
Very cool. All right. So Good Egg Investments has a program called the Real Estate Accelerator. I actually get to participate in a lot of the events where I'm the host for, you know, the Trevor McGregor Mastery Calls and the Real Estate Expert Sessions. We do all this stuff behind closed doors specific for our community. But I was on a real estate mastermind with my other mentor, Julie Lamb, and I was telling her I'm thinking about getting ready to launch my own capital raising programs. And like, I have a little bit of fear and anxiety around whether or not my students will have a great deal of success. And I'm sure I'll be excessively OCD about that specific thing. And she mentioned to me that, you know, in your process, because I was asking her about the scaling as a real estate capital raising mentor. And she mentioned that you guys are about to do an REA, a real estate accelerator 2.0, because your students have evolved and need a different type of information than they did in the beginning. So I'm curious, from your perspective, what does that mean? What, you know, like, what have the you discovered that you need to teach these evolved capital raisers so that you can go 2.0 on this?
Yeah. So for anybody here who may not be familiar, our Real Estate Accelerator program was really born out of just this organic need. Because people were approaching us and asking us how we were seeing this success. And we were trying to hop on these half hour calls with people and sharing, but there's only so much you can do to help people on a quick call. So what we did was then we took, at the time, this was in 2019, we took everything out of the back end of our business that was working, the emails, the automations, the blog posts, everything that was working, and we plugged it into this program and we essentially white labeled it for people to use in the back end of their businesses. And over the last few years, we've had over 150 people go through the program. And after the first year, they can stay on indefinitely, month to month. And I think like 75% of them stay on. And so what's happening is that now we have this roadmap. So there's phase one, where you're building all the tactical stuff, your website, your automations, you're getting your initial blog posts out, your drip campaigns, things like that. And that's very step-by-step. It's easy to say, okay, next step, figure out your audience. Next step, build your website, then build your automations. It's easy to go step-by-step. There's not a lot of guesswork there. But then once you've got that foundation built, then it's about, okay, now let's figure out how to get people into the funnel. Where are my ideal investors hanging out? How do I get in front of them? How do I attract them into my funnel? And how do I optimize this funnel? So that's phase two. Now, where RIA 2.0 comes in is actually in phase three, where we haven't actually put that on the roadmap yet. Phase three is, now that you've built this machine, you've got the foundation, you've figured out how to attract the right people. Now, how do you then extract yourself from that role and make sure that this thing that you've built can run on its own and you can be a true CEO and advise and keep this thing running, but you can bring people into the fold who are experts in their respective fields and help you to run and further optimize this machine that you've built. So that's what RIA 2.0 is all about. It's about the scaling piece and turning this potential side hustle into a full-blown business.
So is this how you're able to go on vacation in the middle of a capital raise for like a month in France?
That's it. That's it. Because we have this team, we have these systems in place, and we hear from a lot of our RIA members. They're like, okay, it's working, but when does it stop? They're like, now I'm busy all the time. I was able to quit my job, but now I'm working harder than I've ever worked before. Yeah, I'm having this impact. And yeah, I'm making great money, but I don't know how much longer I can do this. And so that's the pain point, and that's the relief we're looking to give people. Because if you can get yourself out of that and you can really rise above and build this effective team under you, then you can really drive that ship and you can actually remove the limitations of you as the executor or you in the business. You can work on the business, and that can actually help the business grow even more than with you in it.
I heard through the grapevine, and I can't verify the validity of this, but I heard that, you know, like some of our peers and friends, like Hunter Thompson, who's got a capital raising program, that he started becoming too busy or became busy enough doing the capital raising that he didn't have time to raise the capital. I don't know if I totally believe that or not, but I do, you know, I am a little concerned that if I compare how much money I could make as a subdivision syndicator, you know, it's going to make, you know, maybe 300 to $500,000 or whatever that number is, 30,000 a month being a coach, but I could make way more of that being a syndicator. So for you, what's the, where, you know, where's that line? You know, like, are you going to be too busy doing RIA, or are you going to be able to automate that as well? Tell me about this kind of philosophy and mindset.
Let me tell you a little bit about the history, because we launched RIA in Q4 of 2019, we had no idea that 2020 was around the corner and everything that it would bring. And we just thought, okay, how can we, now that we've sort of established this capital raising arm of the business, how can we, as a still relatively fledgling company at the time, how can we build another stream of income that's entirely separate from raising capital? Because if a recession were to hit, a second stream of income would provide sort of a safety net for us. And so that's really where we saw the opportunity. And so then it was perfect, because we all know what happened in March of 2020. And so all of a sudden, we weren't doing any deals for a period of time as everything just came to a screeching halt. But guess what? Everybody was suddenly at home. They were working from home. They had some extra time. They couldn't go out. They thought, let's give this side hustle a try. I've been meaning to start this capital raising business. Let me get into that. And we had this influx of people who wanted to join RIA. And so it provided this second stream of income. And then what happened was, as we then looked to scale, and I still remember in, I think it was fall of 2020, we hired our first full-time employee at $90,000, which a year, which at the time was like a huge sum of money. We were like, 90,000, that's like 10K a month. Oh my gosh, how are we going to generate that? But then we said, okay, if we just sell, I think at the time it was maybe 10K per RIA seat. We said, if we just sell one new RIA membership per month, we can at least cover that. Right. And so that gave us sort of a baseline, a safety net with which to scale. Because as you're scaling and building team members, if you're just relying on the income from raising capital, it's kind of sporadic, right? Because if you have a deal, then you raise the capital, you make the money. But if you don't have a deal, it could be months where you don't have that consistent income. And so that's what our coaching program has provided, is that second stream of income that's a little bit more under our control and consistent.
Andy, what questions do you have?
Yeah, I want to know, so you have a process then for that avatar, right, which is separate. So I think you call her Jen, your investor avatar, yep. Right? So could you tell us a little bit about that? Because I think many of us, even if we do have some experience in the game, it is very hard to kind of be more specific, right? And what was it? Mitch Hedberg has like a great joke about like walking through the aisle of the grocery store. And he's like, there's, you know, mesquite turkey and there's honey turkey and there's regular turkey. He's like, well, why don't you just be yourself, turkey? So why not try to be more specific, you know, on who it is that you're going after, and then ultimately you'll have more people kind of seek you out. So if you could just talk a little bit about the avatar for the investor and how you created that, and then the avatar for your students.
Yeah, absolutely. So on the investor side, so I will say we didn't know that we needed an avatar the first year that we were in business. And so early on, right, when you're first starting out, you kind of have this intuitive sense of this is who I'm trying to reach, because most often you are your avatar, right? You have these pain points and there are people out there just like you and you're trying to reach them. You may not know it, but that is you are your avatar in most cases when you're starting out. And so that's what got us through the first 6 to 8 months, was we were just like, okay, what do we need? When we were starting out, what were the resources that we needed? And so we started building those. And then as we built those out, at a certain point, we were like, okay, well, we got a lot of those, now what? And then we started to think, well, we're just trying to get anybody in the door, anybody who has some money to invest, let's just get them in the door. And when you're trying to write and create content and connect with everybody, it's incredibly hard. I remember on many occasions I would sit down to write a newsletter and I'd be like, okay, well, I'm trying to reach everyone. What can I write that won't offend them and will connect with them? And it was hard. It was incredibly hard. I'd type something and I'd be like, no, that's too general, and delete it. And I'd be like, okay, let me try this. Oh, no, that's too specific, or that's too much for women, or that's too much for tech employees. And it was just got to this point where I was spinning my wheels and I was like, I don't know what to write. And I got stuck. And that's where writer's block comes from a lot of times, is because you're trying to please the masses. And so then what we did was we sat down and we said, okay, who are we actually trying to target? Let's distill it down into a single fictional person. And we called her Jen. And Jen is still our target investor to this day, but she's evolved over time. And I'll talk a little bit about that as well. So we got together, Julie and I, and we just started putting down ideas. Who is this person? If we had to choose our ideal investor, let's just, like you're making a Christmas list, right? Just make our list of who ideally this person would be. Well, she would have some real estate experience, but she's got a clear pain point. She's got money to invest. She and her husband are accredited investors. They live in an expensive market, so it's not easy to invest where they live, right? So we started putting down our wish list of who this person would be. That became our ideal investor avatar. That's Jen. And so for that carried us for the next couple of years. And everything, every time I sat down to write, I'd write to Jen. And it was great. Now, at the end of last year, we sat down to revisit Jen and we realized, wait a second, Jen has now evolved. The Jens who started with us, they've now invested in 3, 4, 5 deals. They're not new to this space anymore. They're looking for specific, you know, types of deals to fill out their portfolio, to diversify. They're getting more savvy. So then we created Gen 2.0. And now we're actually revisiting because, see, the investor avatar is like a hypothesis that you put out into the world. Right? You have this hypothesis of who you're trying to reach, then you do everything you can through your branding and marketing to reach that person. But the people who actually make it through the funnel may or may not be the exact match to that person. And so it's important to revisit that. And right now we're actually internally having those discussions because we're finding that while we do have conversations with the gens of the world, we also have conversations with retirees and with tech employees. And so we're thinking about how can we not change the brand, because clearly it's working, but also add on some messaging for these specific audiences. So that's how we've sort of evolved it over time.
That's great. Thank you.
Fascinating stuff. All right, cool. So we're going to try and wrap up here in about 15 minutes. So I want to open it up for Q&A, particularly considering we have some very brilliant minds in the audience. So I'd love to hear what you guys are curious about. And, you know, feel free to either raise your hand or come off mute and we can start directing some questions at Annie Dickerson.
Who's first? Lob them at me. I'm ready.
Brian. Brian's got a question.
Sure. Here, let me start the video. What metrics do you track over at Good Egg for your, you know, for your business? I know everyone mm-hmm. always talks about conversion rates, but you know, you don't have conversion rates until you're raising for a deal. You've already raised for a deal. Like as the individuals are coming into your funnel and you're not raising for a deal or closing a deal, what are you tracking?
Ooh, good question. One of my mentors early on told me you can't grow what you don't measure. So early on, we started with a spreadsheet. And in fact, to this day, we're still using a spreadsheet. And every week, we track every part of the funnel. So we track from the top, we track website visitors, the number of website visitors, and the number of impressions as well. So people who may just click, but not actually stay on. So that's from the top, impressions, clicks, website visitors. That's sort of the top of the funnel, the awareness phase. They're just getting to know who you are and the fact that your brand is out there. And then next on the marketing funnel is interest. And so these are people who now know that your brand is out there, but they may just be kind of dabbling around, kicking the tires, seeing what you have. And so for that, we have our book, Investing for Good. So we track the number of book orders per week. And we also have a lead magnet, our 7-day passive investor course. So we track the number of signups there. We also have our podcast. So we track the number of downloads that we have. And then we have a bi-weekly newsletter. And we track the number of the size of that list as it's growing every couple of weeks. And we track the newsletter open rates and click rates. So that's in the interest phase. And then the desire phase, that's the next part of the funnel. And in the desire phase, these are people who they know you're around, they're interested in what you're doing. Now you're trying to build up that desire in them for them to take action. So they might have already signed up for our email course. They might be getting our emails, but for some reason, they haven't invested yet. And so here we do our Good Egg Live webinars and we're tracking the registrations there. Every time we have one of those Good Egg Lives, we're writing down the names of every person who's there live and we look at where they are in the funnel. We also post the recording on YouTube and we look at the number of views there. And so that's sort of that desire piece, is how are we moving them down towards closer to conversion? And then the action, that's the sort of the bottom of the funnel. And that's, it's changed over time, but right now we've distilled it down to the number of signups, particularly accredited investor signups to our investor list, because that's how we've structured our investor journey. So that's the action that we want them to take, is to sign up on Syndication Pro. That's our investor portal. And then from there, then historically we know that of the people who sign up in Syndication Pro with us, roughly half of those people will actually invest in a deal. So then we know that if, let's say, 15 people sign up that week, then we can expect roughly 7 to 8 of them to invest with us within the next year. So those are the sort of the top to bottom of the funnel metrics that we track.
Fascinating. So I was telling, is Jeff still in here? I was telling Jeff Greenberg, oh, there he is. I was telling him that you mentioned, I think it was either you or Julie mentioned, that you've been on like hundreds of podcasts, but the majority of your LPs have come from just like three of the appearances that you've been on. And he was curious, which show was that? You know, I wasn't able to answer him. I don't know if you want to divulge that information or if you could talk about that. Yeah.
Sure. The top, it's actually the top two podcasts were So Money with Farnoosh Torabi. She's a big influencer within the personal finance space. And then Her Money with Jean Chatsky. And so those are still, we did those interviews 2 or 3 years ago, maybe even 4 years ago now. And they're still generating new investor leads for us.
Can you talk about just the concept of finding the right podcast to go on instead of just going on tour to like a bunch of, you know, fun and interesting podcasts, but that don't really generate anything that you're trying to accomplish?
Yeah. Well, I think there's value in doing that tour, so to speak, especially when you're getting started, because when you're getting started, you may not yet be really well versed in being on a podcast or telling your story. And so that's the value of going on these podcasts, these starter podcasts that maybe have 10 episodes in the can, or podcasts that are completely outside of real estate, where you just want to get your podcast guest chops under you. And so that's the value of being on multiple podcasts. But then as you're getting more familiar and better at being a podcast guest, then you can use that as a stepping stone to get into some of these bigger and more well-known podcasts. And that way you have a track record. You can let them know, give them some examples. Because, you know, Ruben, as podcast hosts, right, when we're selecting guests, you got to know that the guest has good stories to tell, that they're going to be personable, that they're going to connect with the audience. It's the worst when you get somebody on the podcast who's like this. They're like, yeah. You ask them this open-ended question and they say, yes. And then you don't know where to go, right? And so the track record shows them that you've been around the block, and that helps you to get onto these bigger name podcasts.
Annie, I'm curious. Well, actually, let's open it up, see if there's any other questions.
I know Jeff has one. He's got his hand.
Okay, go ahead, Jeff.
Hi, Annie. I haven't seen you in a while.
I know. Good to see you.
I wanted to just follow up on some of the podcasts. It sounds like the most popular ones were non-real estate related podcasts. I'm assuming that you're trying to get onto a lot of the non-real estate, but maybe financial freedom, money type of podcasts. So you've been pretty successful at that. Or tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, that's such a good observation. And yes, we have found tremendous success in working or getting ourselves in front of audiences that are tangential to real estate. When you're on a real estate podcast, it's great for building up your track record, but it may not be great for getting new investor leads, because every other episode on that podcast is probably another real estate investor or syndicator. So you're just going to be one among the masses. And when you're, the reason that we like to be on these personal finance podcasts is because in a lot of these cases, people are searching for FIRE, financial independence, retire early. They're on that financial independence path. They know the value. They've read success stories. They know that it's possible. And the way that they've been taught is to do it through investing in stocks and to go after their freedom number. They have this loose kind of abstract idea of what real estate is, but most of them only know rental properties. And for most of them, if you weigh investing in stocks, which is very passive, versus investing in a rental property where you got to invest like tens of thousands of dollars and be involved, at least at the start, it's a huge difference. And that's why they haven't gotten into real estate. But when you can come in and say, no, there's another option that's actually just as passive as investing in the stock market, but can get you way higher returns and can get you to that goal faster. That's why we've had such success, because there's already these audiences that have formed, and we can borrow the trust of that podcast host and show them a new way to solve the pain point that they've already identified.
Now, on that same track, have you also gone to different events, non-real estate related
yes.
events? I would think that would be a great place to be going
as
well.
100%. And the first year that Julie and I were in business, we went to almost entirely strictly real estate events. And it was, I'm sure you guys have had this experience, right? And maybe not recently because of the pandemic, but you know, every few months we would be like, oh, hey, good to see you again. How are the kids? How are you doing? Oh, good to catch up with you, right? You're seeing the same people over and over. And that's what we were experiencing. We would invest all this time and money. We'd go, it was great for building partnerships, but not great for finding investment leads. And so then that next year, we went to all non-real estate conferences. And we swung the pendulum a little bit too far. But the like FinCon, for example, is a great one. It's where money and media meet. There's a growing constituency of real estate investors there as well. But most of the people who attend FinCon are financial advisors, financial coaches, financial influencers. They've got podcasts, they've got YouTube channels, they've got blogs. It's a great opportunity for you to get in front of their audiences. But the reason I say the pendulum swung too far was we went to a Moms 2.0 conference where we thought, oh, all the moms are here. These are mom influencers or side hustlers. They're starting their own businesses. And they didn't want to talk about money at all. They were like, investments? No, we don't want to talk about that. So you kind of have to find that happy medium.
And now that you've been able to track it, so you can kind of look back and now you can track like where you received a lot of, you know, leads from. You got your newsletter, yeah. which sounds like that's been pretty successful. And that inspired us too, because I think mm-hmm. it shows the consistency, mm-hmm. right? Of, hey, these guys can be consistent with putting out a newsletter, thinking about real estate. They're obviously doing deals, really kind of shows credibility. But now that you're looking back, would you pay more for ads, or are you most of your stuff mm-hmm. organic? How has that yeah. evolved over time? I know we got to go, but I'm just really curious, because yeah. I think it'd help a lot of people on here.
Our top source of leads right now is organic. So that all accounts for about 28% of our new investor leads. And second to that is referrals. That's about another 25, 26%. So they're right there between organic and referrals. That's almost 50% of the incoming leads. Ads, we've had an interesting experience with ads, at least the way that we've done it. We're trying to tweak it to change the outcome, but especially when you're advertising for a specific deal, what you get are very transactional investors. It works. And we certainly at the tail end of last year, I remember there was this deal where we invested, I think $10,000 in Facebook ads, just Facebook ads, no other platforms. And it netted $2.5 million invested in the deal itself, which was a great return. But what we found was a lot of those investors that we get through Facebook ads, they invest one time. They don't care who we are. They have no brand loyalty. They saw us one time. They clicked the invest button. They sent us their money, and they're after the returns, right? They're hungry for the returns. There's no brand loyalty there. And also when you shut off the ads, there's no more leads. And so that's how we see it, as the SEO or the organic search, that becomes an asset for the business. Like if you were to stop tomorrow and try to sell your business, everything that you've built on the organic search side continues to go. It's an asset to the business. But everything on the ad side is a liability, because you have to spend money to get those leads. So if you're building your business on all these paid search or paid ads leads, then it becomes unsustainable over time.
Mind blowing. That was an incredible session. So for anybody that wants to get mentored by my mentors at the Good Egg Investments team and the Real Estate Accelerator, you get $1,000 off if you mention either my name or the Capital Raiser Show, or just reach out to Annie and let her know that you heard about the program through here. But other than that, I mean, it's such a pleasure working with you in various capacities, Annie. So thank you so much for coming on and sharing your wisdom with our audience.
Thrilled to be here. Yes.
With that, we'll wrap it up. Enjoy your day, guys. Thank you so much. Ladies and gentlemen, see you next time.
Bye, everyone.
Legacy Acquisitions.